Some of them looked shocked, some confused, but most of them simply looked frightened. When the constables dragged me through the crowd toward the door, barely a handful of my audience were willing to meet my eye. They marched me the long way back to Imre, over Stonebridge and down the flat expanse of the great stone road. All the way the winter wind chilled the iron around my hands and feet until it burned and bit and froze my skin. The next morning, Sim arrived with Elksadal, and matters slowly became clear. It had been months since I had called the name of the wind in Imre after Ambrose broke my lute. The masters had brought me up on charges of malfeasance and had me publicly whipped at the university. It had been so long ago that the lash marks on my back were nothing more than pale silver scars. I had thought the matter resolved. Apparently not. Since the incident had occurred in Imre, it fell under the jurisdiction of the Commonwealth Courts. We live in a civilized age, and few places are more civilized than the university and its immediate environs. But parts of the Iron Law are left over from darker times. It had been 100 years since anyone had been burned for consortation or unnatural arts, but the laws were still there. The ink was faded, but the words were clear. Ambrose wasn't directly involved, of course. He was much too clever for that. This sort of trial was bad for the university's reputation. If Ambrose had brought this case against me, it would have infuriated the masters. They worked hard to protect the good name of the university in general, and of the Arcanum in particular. So Ambrose was in no way connected with the charges. Instead, the case was brought before Imre's courts by a handful of Imre's influential nobles. Oh, certainly they knew Ambrose, but that wasn't incriminating. Ambrose knew everyone with power, blood, or money on either side of the river, after all. Thus was I brought up against the Iron Law. For the space of 6 days, it was a source of extraordinary irritation and anxiety to me. It disrupted my studies, brought my work in the fishery to a standstill, and drove the final nail into the coffin I used to bury my hopes of ever finding a local patron. What started as a terrifying experience quickly became a tedious process filled with pomp and ritual. More than 40 letters of testimony were read aloud, confirmed, and copied into the official records. There were days filled with nothing but long speeches, quotations from the Iron Law, points of procedure, formal modes of address, old men reading out of old books. I defended myself to the best of my ability, first in the Commonwealth Court, then in church courts as well. Arwel and Elksadal spoke on my behalf, or rather, they wrote letters, then read them aloud to the court. In the end, I was cleared of any wrongdoing. I thought I was vindicated. I thought I had won. But I was still terribly naive in many ways. Chapter 46. Interlude. A Bit of Fiddle. Quoth came slowly to his feet and gave a quick stretch.
"Let's pause there for now," he said. "I expect we'll see more than the usual number of people for lunch today. I need to check on the soup and get a few things ready." He nodded to Chronicler. "You might want to do the same."
Chronicler remained seated.
"Wait a minute," he said. "This was your trial in Imre."
He looked down at the page, dismayed.
"That's it?"
"That's it," Quoth said. "Not much to it, really."
"But that's the first story I ever heard about you when I came to the university," Chronicler protested. "How you learned Tema in a day. How you spoke your entire defense in verse, and they applauded afterward. How you..."
"A lot of nonsense, I expect," Quoth said dismissively as he walked back to the bar. "You've got the bones of it."
Chronicler looked down at the page.
"You seem to be giving it pretty short shrift."
"If you're desperate for the full account, you can find it elsewhere," Quoth said. "Dozens of people saw the trial. There are already 2 full written accounts. I see no need to add a third."
Chronicler was taken aback.
"You've already spoken to a historian about this?"
Quoth chuckled deep in his throat.
"You sound like a jilted lover."
He began to bring out stacks of bowls and plates from beneath the bar. Rest assured, you're the first to get my story.
You said there were written accounts,
Chronicler said. Then his eyes widened.
Are you telling me you've written a memoir?
There was a strange note in the scribe's voice, something almost like hunger. Quoth frowned.
No, not really.
He gave a gusty sigh.
I started something of the sort, but I gave it up as a bad idea.
You wrote all the way to your trial in Imre,
Chronicler said, looking at the paper in front of him. Only then did he realize he was still holding his pen poised above the page. He began to unscrew and clean the brass nib of the pen on a cloth with an air of vast irritation.
If you already had all this written down, you could have saved me cramping my hand for the last day and a half.
Quoth's forehead creased in confusion.
What?
Chronicler rubbed the nib briskly with a cloth, every motion screaming with affronted dignity.
I should have known, he said. It all fit together too smoothly.
He glared up.
Do you know how much this paper cost me?
He made an angry gesture to the satchel that held the finished pages. Quoth simply stared at him for a moment, then laughed with sudden understanding.
You misunderstand. I gave up the memoir after a day or so. I wrote a handful of pages, not even that.
The irritation faded from Chronicler's face, leaving a sheepish expression.
Oh. You are like a wounded lover, Quoth said, amused. Good Lord, calm yourself.
My story is virginal. Yours are the first hands to touch it. He shook his head. There's something different about writing a story down. I don't seem to have the knack for it. It came out all wrong.
I'd love to see what you wrote, Chronicler said, leaning forward in his chair, even if it's just a few pages.
It was quite a while ago, Quoth said. I don't know if I remember where the pages are.
They're up in your room, Reshi, Bast said brightly. On your desk.
Quoth gave a deep sigh.
I was trying to be gracious, Bast.
The truth is, there's nothing on them worth showing to anyone. If I'd written anything worth reading, I would have kept writing it. He walked into the kitchen, and there were muted, bustling sounds from the back room.
Good try, Bast said softly. But it's a lost cause. I've tried.
Don't coach me, Chronicler said testily. I know how to get a story out of a person.
There was more bumping from the back room, a splash of water, the sound of a door closing. Chronicler looked at Bast.
Shouldn't you go help him?
Bast shrugged, lounging further back into his chair. After a moment, Quoth emerged from the back room carrying a cutting board and a bowl full of freshly scrubbed vegetables.
I'm afraid I'm still confused, Chronicler said. How can there already be two written accounts if you never wrote it yourself or talked to a historian?
Never been brought to trial, have you? Quoth said, amused. The Commonwealth courts keep painstaking records, and the church is even more obsessive. If you have a desperate desire for the details, you can dig around in their deposition ledgers and act books, respectively.
That might be the case, Chronicler said, but your account of the trial would be tedious, Quoth said.
He finished paring the carrots and began to cut them. Endless formal speeches and readings from the Book of the Path. It was tedious to live through, and it would be tedious to repeat. He brushed the sliced carrots from the board into a nearby bowl.
I've probably kept us at the university too long anyway, he said.
We'll need the time for other things. Things no one has ever seen or heard.
Reshi, no!
Bast shouted in alarm, sitting bolt upright in his chair. His expression was plaintive as he pointed to the bar.
Beets?
Quoth looked down at the dark red root on the cutting board, as if surprised to see it there.
Don't put beets in the soup, Reshi,
Bast said.
They're foul!
A lot of people like beets, Bast, Quoth said. And they're healthful. Good for the blood.
I hate beets, Bast said piteously.
Well, Quoth said calmly, since I'm finishing the soup, I get to pick what goes into it. Bast came to his feet and stomped toward the bar.
"I'll take care of it then," he said impatiently, making a shooing motion. "You go get some sausage and one of those veiny cheeses."
He pushed Quoth toward the basement steps before storming into the kitchen, muttering. Soon there was the sound of rattling and thumping from the back room. Quoth looked at Chronicler and gave a wide, lazy smile. People began to trickle into the Waystone Inn. They came in twos and threes, smelling of sweat and horses and freshly mown wheat. They laughed and talked and tracked chaff across the clean wooden floors. Chronicler did a brisk business. Folks sat leaning forward in their chairs, sometimes gesturing with their hands, sometimes speaking with slow deliberation. The scribe's face was impassive as his pen scratched across the page, occasionally darting back for ink. Bast and the man who called himself Coat worked together as a comfortable team. They served up soup and bread, apples, cheese, and sausage, beer and ale and cool water from the pump out back. There was roasted mutton, too, for those who wanted it, and fresh apple pie. Men and women smiled and relaxed, glad to be off their feet and sitting in the shade. The room was full of the gentle buzz of conversation as folk gossiped with neighbors they had known their whole lives. Familiar insults, soft and harmless as butter, were traded back and forth, and friends had comfortable arguments about whose turn it was to buy the beer. But underneath it all, there was a tension in the room. A stranger would never have noticed it, but it was there, dark and silent as an undertow. No one spoke of taxes or armies or how they had begun to lock their doors at night. No one spoke of what had happened in the inn the night before. No one eyed the stretch of well-scrubbed wooden floor that didn't show a trace of blood. Instead, there were jokes and stories. A young wife kissed her husband, drawing whistles and hoots from the rest of the room. Old man Benton tried to lift up the hem of the widow Creel's skirt with his cane, cackling when she swatted him. A pair of little girls chased each other around the tables, shrieking and laughing while everyone watched and smiled fond smiles. It helped a bit. It was all that you could do. The inn's door banged open. Old Cobb, Graham, and Jake trudged in out of the brilliant midday sunlight.
"Hello, Coat!"
Old Cobb called, looking around at the handful of people spread around the inn.
"You've got a bit of a crowd in here today."
"You missed the bigger part of it," Bast said. "We were downright frantic for a while."
"Anything left for the stragglers?" Graham asked as he sank onto his stool.
Before he could reply, a bull-shouldered man clattered an empty plate onto the bar and set a fork down gently beside it.
"That," he said in a booming voice, "was a damn fine pie."
A thin woman with a pinched face stood next to him.
"Don't you cuss, Elias," she said sharply. "There's no call for that."
"Oh, honey," the big man said. "Don't get yourself in a twit. Damn fine is a kind of apple, isn't it?"
He grinned around at the folks sitting at the bar.
"Sort of foreign apple from off an Ator. They named it after Baron Damfine, if I remember correct."
Graham grinned back at him.
"I think I heard that."
The woman glared at all of them. "I got these from the Bentons," the innkeeper said meekly.
"Oh,"
the big farmer said with a smile.
"That's my mistake, then."
He picked up a crumb of crust from the plate and chewed it speculatively.
"I'd swear it was a damn fine pie for all that. Maybe the Bentons got them some damn fine apples and don't know it."
His wife sniffed, then saw Chronicler sitting idle at his table and pulled her husband away. Old Cobb watched them go, shaking his head.
"I don't know what that woman needs in her life to make her a little happy," he said. "But I hope she finds it before she pecks old Eli bloody."
Jake and Graham made vague grumbles of agreement.
"Nice to see folks filling up the place."
Old Cobb looked at the red-haired man behind the bar.
"You're a fine cook, Coat, and you've got the best beer in 20 miles. All folk need is a bit of an excuse to stop by."
Old Cobb tapped the side of his nose speculatively.
You know, he said to the innkeeper, you should bring in a singer or summit on nights. Hell, even the Orison boy can play a bit of his daddy's fiddle. I bet he'd be glad to come in for the price of a couple drinks.
He looked around at the inn.
A little music is just what this place needs.
The innkeeper nodded. His expression was so easy and amiable, it almost wasn't an expression at all.
I expect you're right, Coates said.
His voice was perfectly calm. It was a perfectly normal voice. It was colorless and clear as window glass. Old Cobb opened his mouth, but before he could say anything else, Bass rapped one knuckle hard on the bar.
Drinks?
He asked the men sitting at the bar. I'm guessing you'd all like a little something before we bring you out a bite to eat. They did, and Bast bustled around behind the bar, pulling beer into mugs and pressing them into waiting hands. After a slow moment, the innkeeper swung silently into motion alongside his assistant, heading into the kitchen to fetch soup, and bread with butter, and cheese, and apples.
Chapter 47 Interlude The Hempen Verse. Chronicler smiled as he made his way to the bar.
That's a solid hour's work, he said proudly as he took a seat. I don't suppose there's anything left in the kitchen for me. Or any of that pie Eli mentioned, Jake asked hopefully.
I want pie too,
Bast said, sitting next to Jake, nursing a drink of his own. The innkeeper smiled, wiping his hands on his apron.
I think I might have remembered to set one by, just in case you three came in later than the rest.
Old Cobb rubbed his hands together.
Can't remember the last time I had warm apple pie, he said.
The innkeeper went back into the kitchen. He pulled the pie from the oven, sliced it, and laid the pieces neatly onto plates. By the time he carried them out toward the tap room, he could hear raised voices in the other room.
It was too a demon, Jake,
old Cobb was saying angrily.
I told you last night and I'll tell you again 100 times. I'm not a one to change my mind like other folk change their socks.
He held up a finger.
He called up a demon and it bit this fellow and sucked out his juice like a plum. I heard it from a fellow who knew a woman that seen it herself. That's why the constable and the deputies came and hauled him off. Meddling with dark forces is against the law over in Amory.
I still say folk just thought it was a demon, Jake persisted. You know how folk are.
I know folk, old Cobb scowled. I've been around longer than you, Jacob, and I know my own story, too.
There was a long moment of tense silence at the bar before Jake looked away.
I was just saying, he muttered.
The innkeeper slid a bowl of soup toward Chronicler.
What's this, then?
The scribe gave the innkeeper a sly look.
Cobb's telling us about Quoth's trial in Imre, he said, a hint of smugness in his voice. Don't you remember? He started the story last night, but only made it halfway through.
Now!
Cobb glared around as if daring them to interrupt.
It was a tight spot! Quoth knew if he was found guilty, they'd string him up and let him hang.
Cobb made a gesture to one side of his neck like he was holding a noose, tilting his head to the side.
But Quoth had read a great many books when he was at the university, and he knew himself a trick.
Old Cobb stopped to take a forkful of pie and closed his eyes for a moment as he chewed.
Oh, Lord and Lady, he said to himself. That's a proper pie. I swear it's better than me ma'am used to make. She always skint on the sugar.
He took another bite, a blissful expression spreading over his weathered face.
So, Quoth knew a trick,
Chronicler prompted.
What? Oh!
Cobb seemed to remember himself.
Right. You see, there's 2 lines in the Book of the Path. And if you can read them out loud in the old Tema only priests know, then the Iron Law says you get treated like a priest. That means a Commonwealth judge can't do a damn thing to you. If you read those lines, Your case has to be decided by the church courts.
Old Cobb took another bite of pie and chewed it slowly before swallowing.
Those two lines are called the hempen verse, because if you know them, you can keep yourself from getting strung up. The church courts can't hang a man, you see.
What are the lines? Bast asked.
I dearly wish I knew, Old Cobb said mournfully, but I don't speak Tema. Quoth didn't know it himself, but he memorized the verse ahead of time. Then he pretended to read it, and the Commonwealth Court had to let him go. Quoth knew he had 2 days until a Talon justice could make it all the way to Emery, so he set about learning Tema. He read books and practiced for a whole day and a whole night, and he was so powerful smart that at the end of his studying, he could speak Tema better than most folk who had been doing it their whole lives. Then, on the second day before the justice showed up, Quoth mixed himself a potion. It was made out of honey, and a special stone you find in a snake's brain, and a plant that only grows at the bottom of the sea. When he drank the potion, it made his voice so sweet, anyone who listened couldn't help but agree with anything he said. So, when the justice finally showed up, the whole trial only took 15 minutes, Cobb said, chuckling. Quoth gave a fine speech in perfect Tema. Everyone agreed with him, and they all went home.
And he lived happily ever after, the red-haired man said softly from behind the bar. Things were quiet at the bar. Outside, the air was dry and hot, full of dust and the smell of chaff. The sunlight was hard and bright as a bar of gold. Inside the Waystone, it was dim and cool. The men had just finished the last slow bites of their pie, and there was still a little beer in their mugs. So they sat for a little while longer, slouching at the bar with the guilty air of men too proud to be properly lazy. "I never much cared for Quoth stories myself," the innkeeper said matter-of-factly as he gathered up everyone's plates. Old Cobb looked up from his beer.
"That so?"
The innkeeper shrugged. "If I'm going to have a story with magic, I'd like it to have a proper wizard in it. Someone like Taberlin the Great, or Serapha, or the Chronicler." At the end of the bar, the scribe didn't choke or startle. He did pause for half a second, though, before lowering his spoon back into his second bowl of soup. The room went comfortably quiet again as the innkeeper gathered up the last of the empty plates and turned toward the kitchen. But before he could get through the doorway, Graham spoke up. "The Chronicler," he said. "I haven't ever heard of him." The innkeeper turned back, surprised.
"You haven't?"
Graham shook his head.
"I'm sure you have," the innkeeper said. "He carries around a great book, and whatever he writes down in that book comes true."
He looked at all of them expectantly. Jake shook his head, too. The innkeeper turned to the scribe at the end of the bar, who was keeping his attention on his food.
"You've heard of him, I'm sure," Coates said. "They call him Lord of Stories, and if he learns one of your secrets, he can write whatever he wants about you in his book."
He looked at the scribe. "Haven't you ever heard of him?" Chronicler dropped his eyes and shook his head. He dipped the crust of his bread in his soup and ate it without speaking. The innkeeper looked surprised.
"When I was growing up, I liked the Chronicler more than Taberlin or any of the rest. He's got a bit of fairy blood in him, and it's made him sharper than a normal man. He can see for 100 miles on a cloudy day and hear a whisper through a thick oak door. He can track a mouse through a forest on a moonless night."
"I've heard of him," Bass said eagerly. "His sword is named Sheev, and the blade is made of a single piece of paper. It's light as a feather, but so sharp that if he cuts you, you see the blood before you even feel it."
The innkeeper nodded. "And if he learns your name, he can write it on the blade of the sword and use it to kill you from 1,000 miles away."
"But he's got to write it in his own blood," Bast added. "And there's only so much space on the sword. He's already written 17 names on it, so there's not that much room left."
"He used to be a member of the High King's Court in Modeg," Coates said, but he fell in love with the High King's daughter. Graham and old Cobb were nodding now. This was familiar territory. Coate continued, "When Chronicler asked to marry her, the High King was angry, so he gave Chronicler a task to prove he was worthy." The innkeeper paused dramatically. "Chronicler can only marry her if he finds something more precious than the princess and brings it back to the High King." Graham made an appreciative noise. "That's a pisser of a task. What's a man to do? You can't bring something back and say, 'Here, this is worth more than your little girl.'" The innkeeper gave a grave nod. "So Chronicler wanders the world looking for ancient treasures and old magics, hoping to find something he can bring back to the king." "Why doesn't he just write about the king in his magic book?" Jake asked. "Why doesn't he write down, 'And then the king stopped being a bastard and let us get married already?'" "Because he doesn't know any of the king's secrets," the innkeeper explained. "And the High King of Modag knows some magic and can protect himself. Most importantly, he knows Chronicler's weaknesses. He knows if you trick Chronicler into drinking ink, he has to do the next 3 favors you ask him. And more important, he knows Chronicler can't control you if you have your name hidden away somewhere safe. The High King's name is written in a book of glass, hidden in a box of copper, and that box is locked away in a great iron chest where nobody can touch it." There was a moment's pause as everyone considered this. Then old Cobb began nodding thoughtfully. "That last bit tickled my memory," he said slowly. "I seem to remember a story about this Chronicler fellow going to look for a magic fruit. Whoever ate the fruit would suddenly know the names of all things, and he'd have powers like Taberlin the Great." The innkeeper rubbed his chin, nodding slowly. "I think I heard that one too," he said. "But it was a long time ago, and I can't say as I remember all the details." "Ah, well," old Cobb said as he drank the last of his beer and knocked down his mug. "Nothing to be ashamed of, Coate. Some folk are good at remembering and some ain't. You make a fine pie, but we all know who the storyteller is round here." Old Cobb climbed stiffly down off his stool and motioned to Graham and Jake. "Come on, then. We can walk together as far as Byra's place. I'll tell you two all about it. Now this Chronicler, he's tall and pale and thin as a rail, with hair as black as ink." The door of the Waystone Inn banged closed. "What in God's name was that all about?" Chronicler demanded. Quoth looked sideways at Chronicler. He smiled a small, sharp smile. "How does it feel?" he asked. "Knowing people out there are telling stories about you."
"They're not telling stories about me," Chronicler said. "They're just a bunch of nonsense."
"Not nonsense," Quoth said, seeming a little bit offended.
"It might not be true, but that doesn't mean it's nonsense."
He looked at Bast. "I'd like the paper sword." Bast beamed.
"The king's task was a nice touch, Reshi. I don't know about the fairy blood, though."
"Demon blood would have been too sinister," Quoth said. "He needed a twist."
"At least I won't have to hear him tell it," Chronicler said sullenly, prodding a bit of potato with his spoon.
Quoth looked up, then chuckled darkly.
"You don't understand, do you? A fresh story like that on a harvest day? They'll be at it like a child with a new toy. Old Cobb will talk about Chronicler to 12 people while they're bucking hay and drinking water in the shade. Tonight at Shep's Wake, folk from 10 towns will hear about the Lord of Stories. It will spread like a fire in a field."
Chronicler looked back and forth between the two of them, his expression vaguely horrified.
"Why?"
"It's a gift," Quoth said.
"You think I want this?" Chronicler said incredulously. "Fame?"
"Not fame," Quoth said grimly. "Perspective. You go rummaging around in other people's lives. You hear rumors and go digging for the painful truth beneath the lovely lies. You believe you have a right to these things, but you don't." He looked hard at the scribe.
When someone tells you a piece of their life, they're giving you a gift, not granting you your due. Kvothe wiped his hands on the clean linen cloth. I'm giving you my story with all the grubby truths intact, all my mistakes and idiocies laid out naked in the light. If I decide to pass over some small piece because it bores me, I'm well within my rights. I won't be goaded into changing my mind by some farmer's tale. I'm not an idiot. Chronicler looked down at his soup.
It was a little heavy-handed, wasn't it?
It was, Kvothe said. Chronicler looked up with a sigh and gave a small, embarrassed smile.
Well, you can't blame me for trying.
I can, actually, Kvothe said.
But I believe I've made my point. And for what it's worth, I'm sorry for any trouble that might cause you.
He gestured to the door and the departed farmers. I might have overreacted a bit. I've never responded well to manipulation. Kvothe stepped out from behind the bar, heading to the table near the hearth. Come on now, both of you. The trial itself was tedious business, but it had important repercussions. Chapter 48 A Significant Absence. I went through the admissions lottery and was lucky enough to draw a late slot. I was glad for the extra time, as my trial had left me little opportunity to study for my exams. Still, I wasn't terribly worried. I had time to study and free access to the archives. What's more, for the first time since I'd come to the university, I wasn't a pauper. I had 13 talents in my purse. Even after I paid Davy the interest on her loan, I would easily have enough for tuition. Best of all, the long hours spent searching for the Graham had taught me a great deal about the archives. While I might not know as much as an experienced scriv, I was familiar with many of her hidden corners and quiet secrets. So while I studied, I also allowed myself the freedom to do other reading while I prepared for admissions. I closed the book I'd been poring over, a well-written comprehensive history of the Aeturan Church. It was as useless as all the rest. Willem looked up as my book thumped shut.
Nothing? He asked.
Less than nothing, I said. The two of us were studying in one of the fourth-floor reading halls, much smaller than our customary place on the third floor, but given how close we were to admissions, we'd been lucky to find a private room at all.
Why don't you let it go? Will suggested. You've been beating this Amir thing like a dead horse for what? 2 span?
I nodded, not wanting to admit my research into the Amir had actually started long before our bet had taken us to Puppet.
And what have you found so far?
Shelves of books, I said. Dozens of stories. Mentions in 100 histories. He gave me a level look.
And this wealth of information irritates you.
No, I said. The lack of information troubles me. There isn't any solid information about the Amir in any of these books.
None? Willem said skeptically.
Oh, every historian in the last 300 years talks about them, I said. They speculate on how the Amir influenced the decline of the Empire. Philosophers talk about the ethical ramifications of their actions. I gestured to the books. That tells me what people think about the Amir. It doesn't tell me anything about the Amir themselves. Willem frowned at my stack of books.
It can't all be historians and philosophers.
There are stories too, I said. Early on, there are stories about the great wrongs they righted. Later, you get stories about the terrible things they did. An Amir in Rhaenyra kills a corrupt judge. Another in Jumpui puts down a peasant uprising. A third in Melithi poisons half the town's nobility.
And that isn't solid information? Willem asked.
They're soft stories, I said. Second or third hand. 3/4 of them are simply hearsay. I can't find corroborating evidence for them anywhere. Why can't I find any mention of the corrupt judge in the church records? His name should be recorded in every case he tried. What was the date of this peasant uprising? And why can't I find it mentioned in any of the other histories?
It was 300 years ago, Willem said reproachfully. You can't expect all those little details to survive.
I expect some of the little details to survive. You know how obsessive the Talons are about their records, I said. We have 1,000 years of court documents from 100 different cities squirreled away down in Sub 2, whole rooms full... I waved my hands dismissively. But fine, let's abandon the small details. There are huge questions I can't find any answers for. When was the Order Aemir founded? How many Aemir were there? Who paid them and how much? Where did that money come from? Where were they trained? How did they come to be a part of the Talon Church?
Feltemi Rice answered that, Willem said. They grew out of the tradition of the mendicant judges.
I picked up a book at random and thumped it onto the table in front of him. Find me one bit of proof to support that theory. Find me one record that shows a mendicant judge being promoted into the ranks of the Aemir. Show me one record of an Aemir being employed by a court. Find me one church document that shows an Aemir presiding over a case. I crossed my arms in front of my chest belligerently. Go on. I'll wait.
Willem ignored the book. Maybe there weren't as many Aemir as people assume. Perhaps there were only a few of them, and their reputation grew out of their control.
He gave me a pointed look.
You should understand how that works.
No, I said. This is a significant absence. Sometimes finding nothing can be finding something.
You're starting to sound like Elodin, Willem said.
I frowned at him, but decided not to rise to the bait. No, listen for a minute. Why would there be so little factual information about the Aemir? There are only 3 possibilities. I held up fingers to mark them off. 1, nothing was written down. I think we can safely discard that. They were too important to be entirely neglected by historians, clerks, and the obsessive documentation of the church. I tucked that finger away. 2, by an odd chance, copies of the books that do have this information have simply never made their way here to the archives. But that's ridiculous. It's impossible to think that over all the years, nothing on the subject has ended up in the largest library in the world. I folded down the second finger. 3. I pointed with the remaining finger. Someone has removed this information, altered it, or destroyed it.
Willem frowned. Who would do that?
Who indeed, I said. Who would benefit most from the destruction of the information of the Aemir? I hesitated, letting the tension build. Who else but the Aemir themselves? I had expected him to dismiss my idea, but he didn't.
An interesting thought, Willem said. But why assume the Aemir are behind it? It is much more sensible to think the church itself is responsible. Certainly the Talons would like nothing better than to quietly erase the Aemir's atrocities.
True, I admitted. But the church isn't very strong here in the Commonwealth, and these books come from all over the world. A Sealdish historian wouldn't have any compunctions about writing a history of the Aemir.
A Sealdish historian would have very little interest in writing the history of a heretic branch of a pagan church, Willem pointed out. Besides, how could a discredited handful of Aemir do something the church itself could not achieve?
I leaned forward. I think the Aemir are far older than the Talon Church, I said. During the time of the Aeturan Empire, a great deal of their public strength was with the church, but they were more than just a group of wandering justices.
And what leads you to this belief? Willem said.
From his expression, I could see I was losing Willem's support rather than gaining it. A piece of ancient pottery, I thought. A story I heard from an old man in Tarbian. I know it because of something the Chandrian let slip after they killed everyone I ever knew. I sighed and shook my head, knowing how crazy I would sound if I told the truth. That was why I scoured the archives. I needed some tangible evidence to support my theory. Something that wouldn't make me a laughingstock. I found copies of the court documents from the time the Aemir were denounced, I said. Do you know how many Aemir they put on trial in Tarbian? Will shrugged. I held up a single finger. 1. 1 Aemir in all of Tarbian. and the clerk writing the transcript of the trial made it clear the man they put on trial was a simpleton who didn't understand what was going on. I still saw doubt on Willem's face. "Just think on it," I pleaded. "The scraps I found suggest there were at least 3,000 Aemir in the Empire before they were disbanded. 3,000 highly trained, heavily armed, wealthy men and women absolutely devoted to the greater good. Then, one day the church denounces them, disbands their entire order, and confiscates their property." I snapped my fingers. "And 3,000 deadly, justice-obsessed fanatics just disappear? They roll over and decide to let someone else take care of the greater good for a while? No protest? No resistance? Nothing?" I gave him a hard look and shook my head firmly. "No. That goes against human nature. Besides, I haven't found one record of a member of the Aemir being brought before the church's justice. Not one. Is it so outrageous to think they might have decided to go underground to continue their work in a more secret way? And if that's reasonable," I continued before he could interrupt, "doesn't it also make sense they might try to preserve their secrecy by carefully pruning histories over the last 300 years? There was a long pause. Willem didn't dismiss it out of hand.
"An interesting theory," he said slowly. "But it leads me to one last question."
He eyed me seriously.
"Have you been drinking?"
I slumped in my chair.
"No."
He came to his feet.
"Then you should start. You have been spending too much time with all these books. You need to wash the dust from your brains."
So we went for a drink, but I still harbored my suspicions. I bounced the idea off Simon when I next had the chance. He accepted it more easily than Willem had, which isn't to say he believed me, just that he accepted the possibility. He said I should mention it to Lauren. I didn't. The blank-faced Master Archivist still made me nervous, and I avoided him at every opportunity for fear I might give him some excuse to ban me from the archives. The last thing I wanted to do was suggest his precious archives had been slowly pruned over the last 300 years. Chapter 49. The Ignorant Edema. I saw Elxadal raise a hand in greeting from across the courtyard.
"Quoth," he smiled warmly, "the very fellow I was hoping to see. Could I borrow a moment of your time?"
"Of course," I said. While I liked Master Dahl, we hadn't had much contact together outside the lecture hall. "Could I buy you a drink or a bite of lunch? I've been meaning to thank you more properly for speaking on my behalf at the trial, but I've been busy."
"As have I," Dahl said. "I've actually been meaning to talk to you for days, but time keeps getting away from me."
He looked around.
"I wouldn't turn down a bit of lunch, but I should probably forego the drink. I have admissions to oversee in less than an hour."
We stepped into the White Hart. I'd barely even seen the inside of the place, as it was far too rich for the likes of me. Elxadal was recognizable in his dark master's robes, and the host fawned a bit as he led the two of us to a private table. Dahl seemed perfectly at his ease as he took a seat, but I was increasingly nervous. I couldn't imagine why the master sympathist would seek me out for a conversation.
"What can I bring you?"
asked the tall, thin man as soon as we were in our chairs.
"Drinks, a selection of cheeses. We have a delightful lemon trout as well."
"The trout and cheeses would do nicely," Dahl said.
The host turned to me.
"And yourself?"
"I'll try the trout as well," I said.
"Wonderful,"
he said, rubbing his hands together in anticipation.
"And to drink?"
"Cider," I said.
"Do you have any fallows red?" Dahl asked hesitantly.
"We do," said the host. "And it's a lovely year, too, if I do say so myself."
"I'll have a cup," Dahl said, glancing at me.
"One cup shouldn't alter my judgment too badly."
The host hurried away, leaving me alone at the table with Elxadal. It felt odd sitting across the table from him. I shifted nervously in my seat.
So, how are things with you? Dahl asked conversationally.
Passing fair, I said. It was a good term with the exception of... I made a gesture toward Imre.
Dahl gave a humorless chuckle.
That was a brush with the old days, wasn't it?
He shook his head.
Consortation with demons. Good Lord.
The host returned with our drinks and left without a word. Master Dahl picked up his wide clay cup and held it in the air.
To not getting burned alive by superstitious folk, he said.
I smiled despite my discomfiture and raised my wooden mug. A fine tradition. We both drank, Dahl sighing appreciatively at the wine. Dahl looked at me across the table.
So tell me, he said. Have you ever considered what you're going to do with yourself when you're done here? After you have your guilder, I mean.
I haven't thought of it that much, I admitted honestly. It seems such a long way off.
At the rate you're rising through the ranks, it might not be so long at that.
Already a relar at... How old are you again?
17,
I lied smoothly. I was sensitive about my age. Many students were nearly 20 before they enrolled in the university, let alone joined the Arcanum.
17, Dahl mused softly. It's so easy to forget that. You carry yourself so tall.
His eyes got a faraway look in them.
Lord and lady, I was a mess at 17. My studies, trying to sort out my place in the world. Women.
He shook his head slowly.
It gets better, you know. Give it 3 or 4 years and everything settles down a bit.
He raised his clay cup to me briefly before taking another drink.
Not that you seem to be having much trouble. Relar at 17. Quite a mark of distinction.
I flushed a bit, not knowing what to say. The host returned and began laying dishes on the table, a small board with an array of different sliced cheeses, a bowl with small toasted pieces of bread, a bowl of strawberry preserves, a bowl of blueberry jam, a small dish of shelled walnuts.
Dahl picked up a small piece of bread and a slice of crumbling white cheese.
You're quite the sympathist, he said. There are any number of opportunities out there for a person as skilled as yourself.
I spread a bit of strawberry across a piece of cheese and toast, then put it into my mouth to give myself time to think. Was Dahl implying he wanted me to focus more on my study of sympathy? Was he implying he wanted to sponsor me to Eltha? Elodin had sponsored my elevation to Raylar, but I knew these things changed. Masters occasionally fought over particularly promising students. Mola, for example, had been a scriv before Arwill stole her away into the Medica.
I do enjoy my study of sympathy quite a bit, I said carefully. That's abundantly clear, Dahl said with a smile. Some of your classmates wish you enjoyed it a little less, I can assure you of that.
He ate another piece of cheese, then continued.
That said, it is possible to overdo it. Didn't Tekum say too much study harms the student?
Ertram the Wiser, actually, I said.
It had been in one of the books Master Lauren had set aside for Relar to study this term.
It's true, at any rate, he said. You might want to consider taking a term off to relax a bit. Travel a little. Get some sun.
He took another drink.
It's not good to see one of the Adimaru without a tan.
I didn't know what to say to that. The thought of taking a holiday from the university had never occurred to me. Where would I possibly go?
The host arrived with plates of fish steaming and smelling of lemon and butter. For a while, both of us concentrated on our food. I was glad for an excuse not to talk. Why would Dahl compliment me on my studies, then encourage me to leave? After a while, Elxadahl gave a contented sigh and pushed back his plate.
Let me tell you a little story, he said. A story I like to call The Ignorant Adema.
I looked up at that, slowly chewing my mouthful of fish. I kept my expression carefully composed. He arched an eyebrow, as if waiting to see if I had anything to say. When I didn't, he continued.
Once there was a learned arcanist,
He knew all of sympathy and sigildry and alchemy. He had 10 dozen names tucked neatly into his head, spoke 8 languages, and had exemplary penmanship. Really, the only thing that kept him from being a master was poor timing and a certain lack of social grace. Dahl took a sip of wine. So this fellow went chasing the wind for a while, hoping to find his fortune out in the wide world. And while he was on the road to Tinue, he came to a lake he needed to cross. Dahl smiled broadly. Luckily, there was an Edema boatman who offered to ferry him to the other side. The Arcanist, seeing the trip would take several hours, tried to start a conversation. "What do you think," he asked the boatman, "about Tekum's theory of energy as an elemental substance rather than a material property?" The boatman replied he'd never thought on it at all. What's more, he had no plans to. "Surely your education included Tekum's theophany?" the Arcanist asked. "I never had what you might call an education, Yarner," the boatman said, "and I wouldn't know this Tekum of yours if he showed up selling needles to my wife." Curious, the Arcanist asked a few questions, and the Edema admitted he didn't know who Feltemi Rice was, or what a Gearwin did. The Arcanist continued for a long hour, first out of curiosity, then with dismay. The final straw came when he discovered the boatman couldn't even read or write. "Really, sir?" the Arcanist said, appalled. "It is every man's job to improve himself. A man without the benefits of education is hardly more than an animal." Dahl grinned. Well, as you can guess, the conversation didn't go very far after that. They rode for the next hour in a tense silence. But just as the far shore was coming into sight, a storm blew up. Waves started to lash the little boat, making the timbers creak and groan. The Edema took a hard look at the clouds and said, "It'll be true bad in 5 minutes, then some at worse afore it clears. This boat of mine won't hold together through it all. We're gone to have to swim the last little bit." And with this, the ferryman takes off his shirt and begins to tie it around his waist. "But I don't know how to swim," says the Arcanist. Dahl drank off the last of his wine, turned the cup upside down, and set it firmly on the tabletop. There was a moment of expectant silence as he watched me, a vaguely self-satisfied expression on his face. "Not a bad story," I admitted. "The ruse accent was a little over the top." Dahl bent at the waist in a quick, mocking bow. "I will take it under consideration," he said, then raised one finger and gave me a conspiratorial look. "Not only is my story designed to delight and entertain, but there is a kernel of truth hidden within, where only the cleverest student might find it." His expression turned mysterious. "All the truth in the world is held in stories, you know." Later that evening, I related the encounter to my friends while playing cards at Anchor's. "He's giving you a hint, Thickwit," Manette said irritably. The cards had been against us all night, and we were 5 hands behind. "You just refuse to hear it." "He's hinting I should leave off studying sympathy for a term?" I asked. "No," Manette snapped. "He's telling you what I've told you twice already. You're a king-high idiot if you go through admissions this term." "What?" I asked. "Why?" Manette set his cards down with profound calm. "Quoth, you're a clever boy, but you have a world of trouble listening to things you don't want to hear." He looked left, then right at Willem and Simon. "Can you try telling him?" "Take a term off," Willem said without looking up from his cards, then added, "Thickwit." "You really have to," Sim said earnestly. "Everyone's still talking about the trial. It's all anyone is talking about." "The trial?" I laughed. "That was more than a span ago. They're talking about how I was found completely innocent, exonerated in the eyes of the Iron Law and Merciful Talu himself." Manette snorted loudly, lowering his cards. "It would have been better if you'd been guilty in a quiet way rather than be innocent so loud." He looked at me.
Do you know how long it's been since an arcanist was brought up on charges of consortation?
No, I admitted.
Neither do I, he said. Which means it's been a long, long while. You're innocent. Lovely for you. But the trial has given the university a great shining black eye. It's reminded folk that while you might not deserve burning, some arcanists might. He shook his head. You can be certain the masters are uniformly wet cat mad about that.
Some students aren't too pleased either, Will added darkly.
It isn't my fault there was a trial, I protested, then backed up a bit. Not entirely. Ambrose stirred this up. He was backstage during the whole thing, laughing up his sleeve.
Even so, Will said. Ambrose is sensible enough to avoid admissions this term.
What? I asked, surprised. He's not going through admissions?
He is not, Willem said. He left for home 2 days ago.
But there was nothing to connect him to the trial, I said. Why would he leave?
Because the masters are not idiots, Manette said. The two of you have been snapping at each other like mad dogs since you first met.
He tapped his lips thoughtfully, his expression full of exaggerated innocence.
Say, that reminds me. Whatever were you doing at the Golden Pony the night Ambrose's room caught fire?
Playing cards, I said.
Of course you were, Manette said, his tone thick with sarcasm. The two of you have been throwing rocks at each other for a full year, and one of them has finally hit the hornet's nest. The only sensible thing to do is run off to a safe distance and wait till the buzzing stops.
Simon cleared his throat timidly. I hate to join the chorus, he said apologetically, but rumor has gotten around you were seen having lunch with Sleet. He grimaced. And Fella told me she'd heard you were, courting Davy.
You know that's not true about Davy, I said. I've just been visiting her in order to keep the peace. She was half an inch away from wanting to eat my liver for a while there. And I only had one conversation with Sleet. It was barely 15 minutes long.
Davy? Manette exclaimed with dismay.
Davy and Sleet? One expelled and the other the next best thing?
He threw down his cards.
Why would you be seen with those people? Why am I even being seen with you?
Oh, come now. I looked back and forth between Will and Sim.
It's that bad?
Willem set down his cards.
I predict, he said calmly, that if you go through admissions, you will receive a tuition of at least 35 talents.
He looked back and forth between Sim and Manette.
I will wager a full gold mark to this effect. Does anyone care to take my bet?
Neither of them took him up on his offer. I felt a desperate sinking in my stomach.
But this can't, I said. This...
Sim put his cards down as well, the grim expression out of place on his friendly face.
Quoth, he said formally. I am telling you 3 times. Take a term away.
Eventually, I realized my friends were telling me the truth. Unfortunately, this left me entirely at loose ends. I had no exams to study for, and starting another project in the fishery would be nothing but foolishness. Even the thought of searching the archives for information on the Chandrian or the Aemir had little appeal. I had searched so long and found so little. I toyed with the idea of searching elsewhere. There are other libraries, of course. Every noble house has at least a modest collection containing household accounts and histories of their lands and family. Most churches had extensive records going back hundreds of years, detailing trials, marriages, and dispositions. The same was true of any sizable city. The Aemir couldn't have destroyed every trace of their existence. The research itself wouldn't be the hard part. The hard part would be gaining access to the libraries in the first place. I could hardly show up in Rhaenyra dressed in rags and road dust, asking to thumb through the palace archives.
This was another instance in which a patron would have been invaluable. A patron could write me a letter of introduction that would open all manner of doors for me. What's more, with a patron's backing, I could make a decent living for myself as I traveled. Many small towns wouldn't even let you play